Hello, everyone, and welcome to Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things that used to be known as the global war on terror, but what we now call the long war. I'm Edmund Fitton Brown, and I'm guesting here as host while your old friend Bill Roggio takes some well-earned leave. Now, like Bill, I'm a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. And Bill, of course, is the editor of the FDD's Long War Journal, which covers this whole general subject. Now, one of the joys of this guest hosting for me is that the very first person that I'm interviewing is the man who is now doing the job that I used to do when Bill first used to interview me, when I was with the United Nations Analytical Support and Sanctions Monitoring Team, dealing with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. Now, I finished that job in 2022. The man who is now in that hot seat is Colin Smith, my old friend who I used to deal with extensively when I was in the UN, and he was in the British system at that time. So I feel like this is a fascinating bit of role reversal. I used to be the guy who was asked these questions. Now I'm going to try to ask them, and let's see how it goes. So the time of year, of course, is interesting. You may remember that the last time I was on Generation Jihad with Bill in the seat, it was actually to talk about the very latest report that Colin and his team have written. They would have written it in June of this year, and it was released in August. And it was about specifically ISIS and Al-Qaeda, a report to the 1267 committee. And we sort of unpacked some of the detail of that. But now, of course, Colin, who understands much more about that report than I do, knows exactly what went into it, what the priorities were, and indeed, will have a sort of a strong sense of where the report sort of stands in the sort of in the succession of analysis of these subjects. He can tell us from the horse's mouth, as it were. So without further ado, I will introduce Colin Smith from the UN's monitoring team. Colin, welcome to Generation Jihad.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for inviting me. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And, I think the first thing I really want to do is to get a sense of who you are for the audience. As I said, you come from the British system, but you've had a storied career within the British system, and I think quite a varied one as well. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about what led you to end up in New York with the monitoring team.
So, as you say, my name's Colin. I've been in the British foreign system as a diplomat for over 20 years. I dealt with a range of issues. I started out my career largely focusing on the Balkans, actually, and dealing with issues around war crimes and war criminals. And I then kind of moved or gravitated towards issues around national security. So I started out on counter-proliferation, then moved to counter-terrorism. And I've spent a fair chunk of my career working on counter-terrorism or related issues. So, for example, I was head of the UK's Syria office based in Istanbul for a number of years, working on the counter-Daesh campaign. And I ended up dealing with a range of national security issues. I set up the National Security and Investment Act unit in the UK. I was head of the Serious and Organized Crime Department, set of counter-terrorism department. And then I left the office, and I was working for an international development consultancy, and I worked there for about a year until this job came up, and the office got back in touch with me and asked if I'd be interested in applying for the role. So essentially, that's how I ended up being your successor's successor, Edmund. And I've been doing the role for nearly 2 years. And it's been really interesting, very interesting period to be doing this, and some fascinating issues and some excellent insights into what is going on and some great people that we work with. So I feel very privileged to be doing this job.
Well, it seems to me you have the perfect background for it, because it's clear that, you know, slightly unusually perhaps in a diplomatic career, you've been involved in a lot of these sort of what one might call counter issues, where you've been dealing thematically with threats to the UK and threats to national and international security. And that I think leads really well into this. And of course, I do remember specific dealings that we had, in fact, when you were the head of the Foreign Office's counterterrorism department. I remember we were, I think it was in the margins of one of Mr. Voronkov's big New York conferences on counterterrorism that we were talking then. So going back to the monitoring team and how it is mandated and how it does its job, I think for a lot of people, they don't necessarily understand the UN very well. It's a complicated and very, very large organism. And my recollection, even of the whole sort of counterterrorism architecture of the UN, was that that was pretty complicated. And so I wanted to sort of start off by helping people understand a little bit more about what the monitoring team is and how it does its job. And, you know, we can then broaden out into some other sort of UN issues. But first of all, my recollection from when I was there was there were 10 of us with lots of support from UN staff. And the 10 of us were all from different nationalities. And it was a really unusual way for a team to be structured. But it had a wonderfully clear mandate for what it was supposed to do. Perhaps you can tell us all more about the detail of that.
So very briefly, I mean, the history of the monitoring team and of the regime goes back to 1999, Security Council Resolution 1267. I won't go into kind of the depths of the history, though actually we did describe that in one of our recent reports. But in essence, we have a dual mandate. So part of the mandate is under Security Council Resolution 1267. And under that, we look at Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and their affiliated groups. And the other part of the mandate is under Security Council Resolution 1988, in which we look at peace, security, and stability in Afghanistan. And under both of those regimes, we do two principal functions. So the first function is to make sure that the sanctions regime is robust and is implemented as robustly as we can possibly make it. So that means making sure that the processes are in place, that we're monitoring implementation, that any violations are picked up and raised in an appropriate way, to make sure that the lists are as updated as they can be, and the whole subject of discussion there as well. And along with that, along with kind of managing the regime itself, we also report on the evolution of the threat. So under 1267, every 6 months, we write this assessment of the evolution of the threat as it applies to Al-Qaeda and Daesh and their affiliated groups. That's our public assessment. We will also brief the relevant Security Council committee in slightly higher classification. And we also engage with member states at a classification of their choosing, if you like. So we will talk in more detail according to the audience that we're talking to. And the report itself, I think, is very, I do think it's an important report, and it serves several functions. The most basic function of the report is to provide, if you like, justification for the sanctions regime. So it's saying, there is this threat. We're seeing these issues, these challenges, these groups, they're still plotting, they're still planning. We therefore need a sanctions regime to contribute to the efforts to counter that threat. So that's the most kind of basic function of the report, is to show, if you like, why we still need the sanction regime and these restrictive measures. But the report is used in different ways by different audiences. So some international organizations will use the report to prioritize their capacity building. So bits of the UN machinery, OSCE and others will draw on our report to say, well, this is where we're seeing the threat. This is where we're seeing issues. And therefore, this is where we should be building capacity to try and counter that threat or to manage or mitigate that particular threat. And other countries, other regional organizations use the report to kind of peer around the corner. So one of my observations in doing this job is that in some parts of the world, some countries, understandably, have a perspective on terrorism, on the terrorist threat, that is very focused on what is going on within their borders. And I can understand completely why they do that, but that means there's a risk that they don't see some of the threats that are developing around them, or techniques, tools, processes, procedures, that are being developed in one region that might very rapidly manifest themselves in another region. So, for example, in one of the reports we did in 2024, we referred to 13 trainers from a country in the Middle East, from Daesh. There were trainers who had experience on drones who traveled from the Middle East to ISWAP, Islamic State West Africa province, to train them on drone capability. And within a few months, we saw the first armed attacks by armed drones from ISWAP. So I think that's a good example of actually how the threat can appear in one part of the world and can manifest itself very quickly in another part of the world, unless you have that kind of global perspective on the threat, unless you have something like our report, you might not see these issues that are developing in one part of the world that can very quickly manifest themselves in another. Crypto is another great example where we're seeing crypto being used, particularly by groups by ISKP, ISIL Khorasan, and how that is being adopted, those approaches are being adopted by groups around the world. So that's another function of the report, is to flag some of these issues that might be appearing, that might be just around the corner for particular countries. And then another function of the report is to provide a base assessment so countries can engage with one another and they have a base assessment on which to start that discussion. So they don't have to start from scratch. They can say, in the UN report, it says X, Y, Z. Do you agree? What is your impression? Does this match with your understanding? So the report has many functions, and I think it's valuable and it's grown and it's developed over the years to add greater value to our global counterterrorism efforts. And the fact that it is written by a panel that is independent, so we don't answer to anyone. So although I'm from the UK, I don't represent the UK in this role. I think the fact that it's independent is part of the value of it. And the fact also that we have an explicit mandate from the Security Council, and we're the only panel that does have this mandate, this explicit mandate to engage with intelligence agencies around the world, to draw on their insights and their information to describe the threat and to kind of assemble the report. So essentially the way that we work is that we try and engage with as many agencies as we can. We try and do that face-to-face, because it's far better to build personal relationships, relationships of trust, to get the information that we need. We bring it all together, and that is essentially what the report is. It's a composite of member states' intelligence views on these issues, plus our own assessment and expertise and other sources of information. We bring it all together, and that's essentially what the report is. And I hope it's useful, and the feedback suggests that it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. And, I think that the quality of the report is very good. I think a lot of specialists in the field, they look at these reports and they say, wow, you know, this is probably the single most important dump of intelligence, as it were, into the public domain that happens anywhere, that there is nothing else quite like this. So, you know, three times a year, as you say, you know, twice on Daesh and Al-Qaeda. And by the way, I should say for our audience that Daesh is ISIS. So we'll use these two terms interchangeably. There are two a year about Daesh and Al Qaeda, one about the Taliban. And yeah, I mean, you can see the way people react to this. Actually, one thing, Colin, I was going to suggest to you, but you know, tell me if I'm wrong about this. In a way, it seems to me the report is almost more important now than it was, because 10 years ago, people were obsessing over terrorism as a threat, whereas now it has been to some degree removed from the headlines by geostrategic rivalries, wars and conflicts, some of which, of course, have a terrorist component to them. But it does seem to me that when you talk about that early warning system, that's really important here, because even a big country like the United States may sometimes focus on the homeland rather than focus on the overseas dimension. And of course, for smaller countries, often that's going to be the case. They don't have the resources to have global coverage. And the report, particularly this latest one, for example, where it talks about events in the Western Sahel area of Africa, this is important stuff, I think. And yet, it would be very easy for somebody even in Washington, D.C., and certainly in a smaller capital, to say, oh, that's an awfully long way away. I don't really see why that matters. So I sense that that early warning that you refer to is perhaps even more important these days.
I think that's right. You're preaching to the converted. So I feel quite strongly with the report that we don't have any illusions that we are depicting that what we say is 100%. This is the situation as it is. It's a vehicle for discussion, and I think having that discussion is really important. So if people don't agree with what we said in the report, if they think there's some other information that is relevant, please tell us, because we need to use as many sources as we can to paint as accurate a picture as we can. It's really important we have that discussion for the sake of the report itself and the quality of the work, but also because, as you say, it feels like these issues are not being given the airtime that they once were. We need to make sure that there is an appropriate discussion of some of these issues and facts so that an appropriate conclusion can be drawn about what actions should be taken to address them. So making sure that there's that discussion, there's that debate, there's that airtime for these issues, I think is a really important part of what we're trying to do. And if we didn't have the report, it would be so much harder for us to try and engage with countries to discuss what the situation is, what an appropriate response is. So no, I think that's a particularly important part of what we're doing. And especially when I look at 1988 in Afghanistan, there's been a lot of discussion of Afghanistan lately because of the fifth anniversary. But in general, we found that there is less focus on the situation in Afghanistan than there was until quite recently. The member states are increasingly, I wouldn't say dismissing, but they're just focusing less and less on what is going on, which we think is slightly concerning. We think there should be a discussion. I'm not saying people should run around with their hair on fire, but just to make sure that people understand what the issues are and what is going on in Afghanistan. So when we wrote our last report, we had less engagement from member states than I think we've ever had previously. Which is a concerning trend from our point of view.
Yes, certainly I can see that. I mean, that balance between the, I sometimes refer to them by the numbers of the committees, the 1267 and the 1988 committees, 1267 doing ISIS and Al-Qaeda, 1988 doing the Taliban. And you have the two reports for 1267, just the one for 1988. And the two mandates get renewed by the Security Council at slightly different times, I think. And of course, in a way, 1988 has been odd since the Taliban took over back in 2021, because there's always been a sort of a question mark about, you know, if the Taliban are now effectively controlling Afghanistan, then what is the role of the 1988 committee, and how does the monitoring team best support it in that respect? So where do you think that is going, Colin? Where are we on the mandate rotations? And do you feel as if it's easy for you to strike the balance between those two committees?
So 1988 comes up for renewal in February next year, and it's generally an annual renewal. 1267 comes up for renewal, I think, in June, either June or July next year. And the last time it was renewed for 3 years. In terms of balancing our effort between the two, most of the effort, to be frank, goes on 1267, because there's a read across between what's happening in 1267 and the 1988 report. There's a bit of an overlap. That's in terms of some of the terrorist groups that we see in South Asia. Some of the concerns we have in Afghanistan, they apply to both 1988 and to 1267. So balancing effort on both or juggling effort is something that we need to roll with. Clearly, there's a kind of flurry of activity in the run-up to writing the report, a few months before we write the report, to make sure we're gathering the information that we need, to make sure we're doing the engagement that we need, to get those insights to feed into the report.
And so the 1267 rhythm has never changed. You've always had the reports written in June and in December. When will you next be writing the 1988 report?
That's a great question. It's not actually, so in 1267, it's in the resolution, it's mandated, we have to write a report by the end of December, as you say, in the end of June. In 1988 is not actually set out when we have to write the report, it just says we have to do an annual report. The last report we wrote was in November, and before that, I think there had been kind of like an 18-month gap between reports. So the next report we will aim to do before November, probably sometime in October. We're looking at that at the moment, actually. We're gathering information for the 1988 report at the moment, which is why in our most recent 1267 report on Al-Qaeda and Daesh, the section on South Asia was perhaps not as full as it has been in some other reports. That's because some of that information, some of that material will be put into our next Afghanistan report. That's part of the reason. The other reason is because of UN budget cuts, we've had to reduce the length of our report. So when I started here, as I say, I've been doing this job for less than 2 years, our word limit was 10,600 words, but it's been successively cut. So it's now 9,000 or just over 9,000 words. And that's quite problematic for us because it means we're losing fidelity, we're losing some detail in the reports, and we need to be quite careful about what goes into which report, that we're not duplicating the information that we have.
I do sympathize with you on that, because I remember how hard it was to compress into that 10,500 words, and it must be that much harder to do it into 9,000. So yeah, my sympathy with you on that. One last question about 1267 and 1988 before we go into the detail of the 1267 report. As you deal with these issues, and I don't want to, you know, I realize that your discussions within the Security Council are privileged, and I won't press you in any way on that. But, you know, for people to understand that the team is composed of people all of different nationalities, and actually the UN Secretariat support to the team is also pretty diverse in terms of nationality. So you've got a really remarkable sort of mixture of people. And then you submit the report and brief it to the committee of the Security Council, which obviously is also 15 different nations sitting there that you have to satisfy. Is that harder to do in a world where there is more international disagreement, where there's more conflict, where perhaps the Security Council is a little more divided than it used to be? What strikes me about the report is that you've kept the quality up. And I know that you write with unanimity. So in other words, everyone agrees on this stuff. You're not forcing through the British perspective or anything of that kind. And in a way, that strikes me as remarkable. Does that suggest that people still come together on the issue of counterterrorism and they can still agree on that when they might disagree about other things?
Yes, essentially. You said what I was going to say. So essentially, the team is composed of international experts. And I think that's one of the strengths of the team, is the fact that we have diverse perspectives and we have different views to bring to this. So it's not the view of just one country or just one region that expressed in the report. It's the views of many countries and many regions that are expressed. So it is that global overview of the threat. So I do think that's one of the strengths of it. And the fact that we're all independent, although we come from different countries, is also one of the strengths of the team and of how we work. And as you say, the report is agreed by consensus. So every member of the team agrees every word of the report, in essence. In terms of the context in which we're operating, I think one of the great strengths of counterterrorism, actually, is the fact that there is this consensus still on the need to defeat Al-Qaeda and Daesh. No member state doubts that. No member state is not committed to that goal. And so although there may be divisions and disruptions, differences of opinion at the Security Council, in the UN, on a range of issues, when it comes to counterterrorism, there's not. There is pretty much that consensus of, we need to address this. This is still an existing threat. AQ and Daesh have not gone away. They've not given up. They are still plotting. They are still planning. There are individuals who are still committed to external operations. And the only way we're going to address this global threat, it genuinely is a global threat, is if we work together. So I think that consensus and that international support for what we are trying to achieve here and for the CT agenda writ large, I think that's actually quite unique. And I think it's worth nurturing in and of itself because it is very valuable. When we can't talk about other issues, we can still talk about counterterrorism. No matter which country we're talking about, everyone is committed to that goal. And I think that's something that is valuable in what we do and what we're trying to achieve. So yes, there are divisions at Security Council level, as everyone will know, on various issues. But when it comes to counterterrorism, not so much.
Yeah, no, it's great to hear. And I do feel that sort of the human concern that everybody shares not to see civilians brutalized is really helpful because, you know, two countries that may have not the highest level of trust with each other, if one knows that another one is in danger of suffering a terrorist attack, I think still that will trump any political rivalry. And people will go to the other capital and say, you need to know that this could happen and you need to stop it from happening. And I do think that this is an area where we actually sort of help bring people together, which is very encouraging. Now, I wanted to move on to the report itself. And really, the floor is yours on this, Colin. I just want you to tell us what you consider to be the most important things that came out in that report that you published in August.
So I think some of the most interesting things in the report is actually the smaller detail. So it's things like in Somalia, Al-Shabaab's income in Mogadishu has dropped from 12 to 15 million euros, 12 to 15 million dollars per month to about $5 to $9 million. I think that's interesting. Or the fact that AQAP, Aqin Arabian Peninsula, is trying to develop drones that can drop payloads of up to 1 kilogram, which is kind of double what they can do at the moment. Or the fact that ISWAP has taken delivery, reportedly, of 35 commercial drones. Those bits of detail, I think, are what makes the report. And I think it's amongst those issues that make the report valuable. But in terms of the big picture, it's sometimes the little detail that can teach you or can show you or illuminate a bigger picture. So I think one of the things that's really interesting is to do with the ransom payment that we reported on in our previous report at the end of last year, when we reported that a ransom payment had reportedly been made of approximately $50 million, to JNIM in the Sahel, which is an AQ affiliate. Over the last reporting period, over the past 6 months or so, we've had reports, or we've seen how some of this $50 million or so has been spent. So most of it has gone to the Katibas, the JNIM Katibas. And they used it in order to finance their assault on the 25th of April, when they attacked Bamako, Kidal, Kati, killed the defense minister in Kati in a massive suicide car bomb. They used some of that money to finance that assault. Some of the money went from JNIM to AQIM, AQ in the Maghreb, and from AQIM it went to AQAP, and it went to AQ senior leadership. And I think that's really interesting, because there's quite a debate at the moment, I think perhaps more of a debate than there has been previously, about the nature of Al-Qaeda. Talking to agencies over the past 6 months or so, we've heard quite different views about what they think AQ is today. So some have said, well, it's just a consultancy. Some have said, it's more a regional organization. It's not really a global organization. Others have said, no, it's global, but it just can't carry out attacks at the moment. It's waiting for the right moment to carry out attacks. So there's quite a debate about the nature of AQ. But this money, this flow of money, shows us something about the organization, because the money has gone from the Sahel across to the Arabian Peninsula and across to South Asia. And it shows that there is a global network, that AQ thinks and can act globally, and it can transfer resources from one part of the world to another part of the world. So there is some sense of prioritization, possibly even policy or even strategy behind what they're trying to do. So I think this flow of funds, I think, is in of itself quite illuminating about the nature of Al-Qaeda today. So I think that's really interesting. And I hope we can dig into that further in the next report about how AQ is operating, perhaps a bit more about the Shura Council, leadership figures, and so on. I think that's very interesting when it comes to Al-Qaeda and a snippet in the report that actually has much bigger implications. So another interesting thing I find in the report is to do with a statement of the Daesh spokesperson, Al Ansari. Now, there's been reports this morning that Al Ansari has actually been killed in a special forces operation in Yemen. That's not confirmed, but as I say, there have been reports this morning. Al Ansari has not put out a statement for nearly 2 years, and the previous statement by the Daesh spokesperson was very upbeat. It was, we're taking on territory, we're making gains in this area and another area. It was very positive in its view. But this statement, the one that came out earlier this year by Al Ansari, it's very downbeat. It's talking about the difficulties they've had in the past few years. The past few years have been, quote, drenched in blood. And I think it's interesting to see the difference of tone between those two statements in the two-year period. So that's the second thing I would kind of highlight in the report. And the third thing I would kind of look at in terms of the report is the fact that in some ways, ISIL is kind of on the ropes. I mean, I wouldn't want to overstate that. We say it's at a lower ebb in the report. It's the fact that a year ago, it lost its deputy leader, Abu Khadija. He was replaced by Al-Maynouki, who was the head of the Al-Furqan office in West Africa. But he was killed in May this year in an operation by the US and Nigerian forces. So they've lost their deputy leader, their replacement deputy leader of the past year. And that has a knock-on impact in terms of how ISIL is able to operate, in terms of its communications, in terms of the confidence it has as an organization. Its leadership is increasingly isolated. And the Al-Qaeda office, Moomin, has been hiding in the Kalmyskat Mountains because of Operation Hilak by Somali security forces. Al-Maynouki, as I say, has been killed in West Africa. Their leadership is dispersed. Their spokesperson is putting out a statement saying the past 2 years have been drenched in blood and the difficulties they've been facing. And they're not really able to operate in the way that they would like to be able to operate. They're not able to operate as a coherent global network. So the fact that ISIL is kind of at a lower ebb, is kind of on the ropes, I think that's quite interesting as well. And the third thing I think I would highlight in the report is the intensity of the attacks in parts of South Asia. So certainly everyone is focused on Sahel and the JNIM SLA campaign that they launched, that I mentioned earlier, in April, and the intensity of some of the attacks in the Sahel. But at the same time, there's actually been an uptick in attacks by groups such as TTP in Pakistan, and the number of attacks they're claiming is very high, and I don't think that's really getting the airtime or the bandwidth that it potentially deserves, because the intensity of the attacks there is quite striking. So I think the fact that we're seeing intensification in the Sahel and in South Asia, I think that's also worth noting. And if I was to note one additional point, just very briefly, it's also the issue of the camps in northeast Syria. That's been a major development. The fact that 15,000 to 20,000 are unaccounted for, from Al-Hol camp in particular in northeast Syria, that we know that when the Syrian government forces took over control of the camps, or some of the camps in northeast Syria, when they took Al-Hol camp in particular, apparently they found 130 holes in the walls surrounding Al-Hol camp that allowed people to escape. And we believe that 15,000 to 20,000 are now unaccounted for. Now, that's not to say that they're all posing a terrorist threat, but it's a pretty big question mark, and we're keen to understand where these people have gone to, and what their intentions are, and how they're being tracked, how they're being located since then. So it's 3.5 issues there that I think I'd highlight in the latest report.
Well, that's great. Yeah, no, those strike me as really important aspects of the report. I guess I have one perhaps observation and then one question. The observation I'll make is, you know, I'm really glad you mentioned that issue of the TTP and the violence in South Asia. And I suppose that, you know, again, thank goodness we still have the 1988 mandate, because it is really important. That's a war that's going on effectively between the Taliban controlling Afghanistan and then this, you know, whatever is going on across the border into Pakistan. And so really important, I think, to continue to monitor that. The question I have for you is, how concerned should we be about Africa? Because it does look to me as if both Al-Qaeda and ISIS are focusing to some degree on Africa.
So Africa is sometimes being described as the epicenter of the global terrorism threat. That's not quite how I would, I would describe it, because I don't think a continent can be described as the epicenter of anything. But there is, as you say, an increased focus and emphasis by both Daesh and Al-Qaeda on Africa. So we think, according to the figures the member states have given us, Al-Qaeda globally probably numbers in excess of 25,000 fighters. So about 25,000 fighters fighting under the flag of Al-Qaeda or its affiliates around the world. Around two-thirds of those are currently based in Africa. If we look at Daesh, the numbers for Daesh are less. We think they're in excess of 16,000 fighting globally for Daesh. But again, around two-thirds of their fighters are based in Africa. So whether that's the Sahel, the Lake Chad Basin, Central Africa, where we've seen an uptick of violence, and ADF in particular, Allied Democratic Forces, is keen to promote and use propaganda more effectively to highlight what it's trying to achieve. So Central Africa, or in East Africa, and of course there's Al-Shabaab, ISIL and Somalia. Any one of those theatres, they are significant theatres for both AQ and Daesh. And having a focus on addressing the threats from those parts of Africa, from those regions, I think is very important. The areas that we're trying to understand better, we're trying to understand the dynamics better within those regions so we can give better assessments to member states. But yes, I think the trend there is deeply concerning. I wouldn't neglect South Asia in terms of what's happening there, but yes, the trend in Africa is concerning and is something that we should be looking at in more detail.
Great. Well, so one thing I wanted to go on to, and I think this is one of those issues that people should understand, but we probably won't go into too much detail because it can be a bit technical. But we've talked about the role of the monitoring team, Colin. Obviously, you fit into a wider UN counterterrorism architecture. And I think for many sort of lay people in this field, they don't know what the UN does on counterterrorism. And I just wondered whether you could give a sort of just a brief account of that whole sort of UN function.
So as you say, I mean, there's a range of different parts of the UN that deal with aspects of counterterrorism, whether that's the development program, UNDP, or UNHCR, who are addressing some of those broader contextual issues that can have an impact on CT efforts. The Global CT Compact is a group of UN entities and organizations who together work on aspects of CT or have an interest in CT according to their mandate. And there are about 40 members of the Global Compact. So 40 different elements within the UN, entities, organizations, that are engaged to some degree or other on counterterrorism. The three principal bodies, though, working on CT issues, I would say, perhaps four, first of all, us. The way I see it is in terms of it is like a pyramid. And I see us at the top because, of course, because I'm very proud of the monitoring team. And we provide the threat assessment. CTED, the UN's Counterterrorism Executive Directorate, is the bit that then works with member states to identify what the gaps might be in their legislation or capacity gaps in order to try and address the CT threat. And UNOCT, the Office of Counterterrorism, is the bit that does that capacity building. It coordinates the whole, but it also does the capacity building to make sure that individual member states have what they need in place to address the terrorist threat. And I said three, maybe four, because I'd also add there OCT as well as UNODC, which also works in the same area. We work very closely with UNODC. We run workshops, we do capacity building events to work with countries to help build their sanctions capability. So together we're helping build member states' understanding of the issues and also their ability to counter the terrorist threat through using the sanctions regime. So I'd say those are the three to four key parts of the UN system. There's a much larger ecosystem of UN entities that are working in this area, from the development program, HCR, human rights, and so on. So it's a large effort. It's a big focus for the UN, actually, is counterterrorism.
And so just a supplementary question on that. Is it fair to say that dealing with these issues at the international level and providing the kind of support that the UN is able to provide, do you think this is a really important function for bringing member states up to the ability actually to meet the threat, the appropriate level of readiness, and also the appropriate level of state capacity to do so?
Absolutely. I mean, if it wasn't for what the UN is trying to do, I know some people might criticize what we're trying to achieve or say it's not enough. But if it wasn't for the UN and the UN's effort in this regard, I'm not sure who else would be building capability and capacity globally in this way. So there will be regional organizations that might focus on individual countries, but there's nobody who really is taking that global view and that global approach to not just building capability in country X, but trying to build capability in all countries. And I think that's really important it's really important because the terrorist threat will migrate and will move according to where terrorists see or perceive a vulnerability. So if you build capability in one country, they will quickly move bases, they will move their operations, they'll try and exploit the situation in another. So we either play whack-a-mole and chase the terrorists, or we try and make sure that every country has pretty much the basic controls in place and the capability in place to make sure the terrorists can't exploit them, can't exploit the situation or exploit capability gaps in particular countries or regions. So I think the UN role here is critical.
Well, look, thanks for that, Colin. I think we're almost out of time. I mean, I could probably talk to you pretty much all day on these issues if we were allowed the time. But I did want to get that last point in. The UN gets a lot of criticism. Some of it is deserved. But the UN is full of centers of excellence as well. I think there's a lot of excellence in the UNCT architecture. I think it carries out some really essential functions. And I think that the monitoring team is a particular focus of excellence, doing a job that needs to be done. And from the reaction to your reports, I don't think there's any doubt that that people have the highest regard for what you do. So thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure this will not be the last time. I think this may well prove to be the first of many interviews, if you're willing, given your reporting timetable.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity and thank you for your kind words. At the risk of being kind of mutual supporting or sort of mutual backslapping, I think the report gets better and better, and that's because of the work that you have done and my successor has done to make sure that we're continuing to drive up standards all the time. So thank you for what you've achieved through when you were coordinating the monitoring team, and thank you very much for this opportunity today, because I've enjoyed it. It's good, and it's good to talk about the report and to talk about some of these issues.
Thank you, Colin Smith from the UN monitoring team, and that's goodbye from me from Generation Jihad.